So it has been waiting for this moment for a long time. So today we begin the exposition of the Four Noble Truths with the permission of the abbot of Dhammadipa Meditation Center here in Tokyo. Now, the Four Noble Truths were discovered and penetrated and revealed by the Buddha. Buddha had to go through countless lives to accumulate the perfections of paramis just to be able to discover the Four Noble Truths and then teach the Four Noble Truths to all beings. Buddha had so much compassion that he was willing to suffer in the samsara for a very long time. Now, it is said in the books that the time he spent in the samsara cannot be measured even by millions of world cycles. Now, you all know that in order to become a Buddha, he had to go through how long a time? Four incalculables and 100,000 world cycles. Now, even one world cannot be measured in terms of years or in terms of centuries. So even one world cycle is so long that it cannot be described in terms of years or centuries. The four asankhyas, that means four immeasurables, that means one followed by 140 zeros is called one incalculable. Right? This is the number we use, like in science, so or in astronomy, when they want to describe the life of some stars, they use what do they use? Huh? Light years, right? It's something like that. So long that it is almost immeasurable. So during those lives, Buddha suffered a lot, accumulating the paramis, so that at the end he became qualified and he became the Buddha. Actually, he discovered and penetrated the Four Noble Truths and he became the Buddha. And after he became the Buddha, he taught for how many years? Buddha taught for 45 years. So Buddha taught for 45 years, and during those 45 years, Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths again and again. What the Buddha taught, including the Four Noble Truths, were collected and recorded just about 3 months after his parinibbana. You understand the word parinibbana? Parinibbana means passing away death. So just 3 months after his death, disciples of the Buddha who survived him met at a council and collected all his teachings, including the Four Noble Truths, and recorded them by word of mouth. There were no books at those times, so they all memorized what the Buddha taught. And these teachings were handed down from generation to generation until about 450 years after the death of the Buddha. So about that year, the teachings of the Buddha were written down on palm leaves manuscripts. And these were also handed down from generation to generation until today, until this time. And also our teachers, maybe beginning with the Venerable Mahakasapa, taught or explained these four noble truths to their devotees, to their pupils, and these expositions were also handed down from generation to generation until today. And that kind of exposition you find in the book in front of you, in the Visuddhimagga. So we should be grateful to the Buddha for enduring such suffering for a long, long period of time, just to be able to teach the Four Noble Truths to all beings. Because only by the realization of Four Noble Truths can one attain enlightenment. And Buddha's aim is for beings to gain enlightenment so that they could make an end of suffering. They could get out of this samsara full of suffering. So, at the beginning of this talk, this class, let us pay homage to the Buddha and also to the Dhamma and to the Sangha and to our teachers. So please fold your hands up and repeat after me. Homage to the Blessed One, the Worthy One, the Fully Enlightened One. With gratitude and devotion, we pay homage to the Compassionate and Omniscient One, who suffered for a long time, immeasurable, even by millions of world cycles. Doing the practices that are extremely difficult to do. Please bow down 3 times. Next, please repeat after me again. To the Dhamma now. With gratitude and devotion, we pay homage to the Four Noble Truths discovered, penetrated, and revealed by the Compassionate Buddha. Please bow down again. Now to the Sangha. With gratitude and devotion, we pay homage to the Sangha, who brought the teaching of the Four Noble Truths down to the present time. Please bow down. And now, to our teachers. With gratitude and devotion, we pay homage to our teachers who gave us this rare chance to understand the Four Noble Truths by their excellent exposition, without which we cannot understand the Four Noble Truths properly. Please bow down. Before we go right into the Four Noble Truths, We should understand when Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths first. Now, I hope you know that Buddha appeared over 2,500 years ago, and he attained enlightenment as the Buddha on what day? When did he become the Buddha? On what day? You heard about Vesak day? When was that? May, right? Full moon day. On the full moon day of May, the ascetic Gautama became the Buddha. So during on that day, Buddha-to-be went to the Bodhi tree. Right? He sat down under the Bodhi tree about sundown, sunset, and then practiced meditation. So he practiced meditation and the mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati meditation, and he gained first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and fourth jhana. And then he gained also the immaterial jhanas, first, second, third, and fourth. And then during the first part of the night, he gained a supernormal knowledge, a great knowledge, by which he could remember all his past lives. He gained a knowledge by which he could recall all his lives in the past. And that happened during the first part of the night. We will divide the night into three parts. So during the first part of the night, he gained as far as the supernormal knowledge. In Pali, it is called Abhinna. So he gained that knowledge. So he was able to see his past lives. And then he went on practicing meditation. And during the second part of the night, he gained another supernormal knowledge. By that supernormal knowledge, he was able to see beings dying from one existence and being reborn in another existence. So he saw, as it were, on a screen, the beings dying and then being reborn. So he saw that one being dies and then he is reborn in hell, another being dies and he is reborn in celestial existence and so on, because they did kusala karma or akusala karma in their lives. So he saw the working of the law of karma very clearly, as it were on a screen. Suppose a being dies and he is reborn in hell, and he also knew that because this being did evil deeds, akusala means evil deeds in his previous life, and so he was reborn in hell, and then another being died and then reborn in devas or celestial world because he did some good karma in the previous life. So he was able to see that good karma produces good results and bad karma produces bad results. So that supernormal knowledge he gained during the second watch of the night. And he went on practicing, and during the third watch of the night, he contemplated on the paticca-samuppada, dependent origination. He takes each factor in the dependent origination and practice vipassana on these factors. Are you familiar with the factors of paticca-samuppada, like ignorance, karma formations, and so on? You are not? Okay. So he took each one of the 12 factors of paticca-samuppada and practiced vipassana on each of these factors. So he practiced vipassana again and again and again on the factors and the dependent origination, and at dawn he gained enlightenment. That means he discovered the Four Noble Truths, he penetrated the Four Noble Truths, and so he became a Buddha. Now, the word Buddha means one who knows, and also one who makes other people know. So there are two meanings in the word Buddha. Now we should understand this, because most people know that Buddha means one who knows, but that is just one part of the meaning. So Buddha is the one who knows and who makes other people know. That means who knows the Four Noble Truths and makes other beings know the Four Noble Truths. Nowadays, people may talk about Four Noble Truths, or they may teach about Four Noble Truths. That is because Buddha first discovered, and then Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths to all beings. That is why they could teach Four Noble Truths following the teachings of the Buddha. Well, Buddha was the person who first discovered the Four Noble Truths and then taught the Four Noble Truths to the world. So the word Buddha means one who knows Four Noble Truths and also who makes other people know the Four Noble Truths. After he became the Buddha, he spent about 2 months under the Bodhi tree and near the Bodhi tree. Now you may have been to India. No, not yet. Okay. So there are places where Buddha gained enlightenment and where he was born and so on. So Buddha stayed almost 2 months under and near the Bodhi tree. And exactly 2 months after his enlightenment, on the full moon day of what? 2 months after his enlightenment, July, so this month, right? So exactly 2 months after his enlightenment, on the full moon day of July, Buddha went to Banaras, Varanasi. It's a long way, but Buddha went there and preached his first sermon to his 5 disciples. So at that time, his disciples, previous to that day, or maybe about 1 or 2 months, I'm not sure how long, these disciples were disillusioned with the Bodhisattva's practice. And so they left the Bodhisattva and went to another place. So after the Buddha became the Buddha, he thought of teaching. So he thought of teaching his first disciples. So at that time they were a distance away from the Bodh Gaya, where Buddha gained enlightenment. So Buddha went to them to Varanasi, or a place called Isipatana. So they were there, and Buddha went to them and taught his first sermon. Now, his first sermon is called what? Turning the wheel of the Dhamma, right? Dhamma Chakka Pavatana Sutta. So that means turning the wheel of the Dhamma. In that discourse, the first discourse he ever gave to the world, Buddha mentioned the Four Noble Truths. So now we understand how important the Four Noble Truths are. The first sermon is a very important sermon, because in it he disclosed his own discovery and also his main and central teaching. So in that sutta, in that discourse, the Buddha explained to them the Four Noble Truths. And later, during 45 years, Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths again and again. It is a little strange to say that there are four truths. Now, people always say there is only one truth, and different teachers explain it in different ways. That is what people used to say. But in Buddhism, there is not just one truth. The Buddha taught that there are four truths. So according to the Buddha, or the teaching of Buddha, truth means something that is true, that is not untrue, that is not otherwise than is stated. So according to this definition, truth can be anything, whether it is good or it is bad. Anything that is true is truth. Now, fire. Fire has a burning power, right? So, when we say fire is burning or fire is hot, we are stating a truth. Because it is true that fire is hot and it burns. That is why in Buddhism, truth may be either good or bad. Now, among the Four Noble Truths, the second noble truth is craving. Craving, attachment, greed. So craving is an unwholesome mental state, a bad mental state. But that bad mental state, which is called tanha in Pali, is called a noble truth. Because tanha is the real thing that produces dukkha, that produces suffering. So something that produces suffering is called the origin of suffering. So since it is the origin of suffering, since it is the cause of suffering, it is called one truth. Because it is true, it is correct that it produces suffering. Since it produces suffering and it is a fact, the craving is called a truth. Not only a truth, here it's called a noble truth of the cause of suffering. That is because it is discovered by the noble person who was the Buddha. So, anything that is true is called truth in Buddhism, and according to the Buddha, there are four truths. And they are not only called four truths, but they are called four noble truths. That means they were discovered by the noble one, the noblest of the noble, the best of the noble persons, that is discovered by the Buddha. Since they were discovered by the Buddha, who was the noblest of the nobles, these truths are called noble truths. So there are, according to this, four noble truths. Okay, now, what are the four noble truths? Tell them. What are the four noble truths? The four noble truths. The noble truth of suffering. Okay, number one, the noble truth of suffering. And number two, the noble truth of the origin of suffering. And number three, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And number four, the noble truth of okay, this is like a class, not like a demo talk, so you have to do something. So number four, the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Now, you may go to first, you have to find out the chapter, 16. Then you can go to paragraph number 13. There you find the Four Noble Truths. There. So you find the Four Noble Truths there?
Yes.
So the first one, noble truth of suffering. The second one, the noble truth of the origin of suffering. And the third one, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And number four, right, the noble truth of the way leading to or reaching the cessation of suffering. So these are the four noble truths taught by the Buddha in that first sama. Now when Buddha explained the four noble truths, he said, but is suffering, old age or aging is suffering, death is suffering, and so on. So we will go by that and we will study that explanation in detail. Are you familiar with the first sama? No? Oh. Okay, now you go to paragraph 31. What do you find there? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. That is the description given by the Buddha of the Four Noble Truths. The first one, this is the first one. So here Buddha said, birth is suffering, right? That is one thing. And then, aging. So, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, and then what? Is suffering, and then sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering, and then association with and love. Please read it. And the separation from the love, the suffering, and then? Okay, and then? Yes, so this is the explanation of the noble truth of suffering. So we will try to understand each one of them. So Buddha said, birth is suffering. Aging means to get old. Decay is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, and also are suffering. Here, birth means actually not the coming out of mother's womb. Birth here means the conception. Now for human beings, and they have to stay in their mother's womb for say 9 months or 10 months, and then the mother gives birth to the child. But here birth means not giving birth to the child, but the moment when conception takes place. So the very beginning of one life, so that is called jati or birth here. So according to this teaching, birth begins not with coming out of the mother's body, but begins with the moment when conception takes place. So from that time on, it is called jati or birth. So here Buddha said that birth is suffering. Now to be in the mother's womb and then to be born, all these involve suffering. The baby has to stay in the mother's body for a long time in a very narrow place and so on, and you can imagine how a baby would suffer before it was born. So Buddha said birth is suffering. In the commentary there's a long description of how great the suffering there is, and during the time when the baby is in the mother's womb and so on, and you can read it later. So birth is described as suffering. Why is birth suffering? Birth is called suffering because it is the base for all suffering. Now once there is a rebirth, there is also old age and death and disease and so on. So all these we encounter or we experience because there is birth. If there were no birth, we would not suffer all these things. So since birth is the base for all suffering, birth is also described as suffering. Now, you turn to paragraph 42. Four lines down, you will say all this this jati is the base for all this dukkha, or something like that. Just above the verse. Thus, first rebirth is, this rebirth is the base of all dukkha, something like that. There are verses, right? Yeah, above the verses, what do you find? Yeah, right. Base or something. Right. So, jati, no? Birth is said to be suffering or dukkha because it is the base for suffering. So you note it down in your note paper. You say here birth, right? And on the other space you say because it is the base. This is for suffering. So birth is said to be suffering because it is the basis for all suffering we experience in one life. The next one is jara, I mean aging or getting old. So getting old is also described as suffering. Getting old means not when you become 40, 50, 60, 70 years of age, but getting old begins immediately after birth. So immediately after birth there is the aging, because moment after moment you are becoming older and older. Now you, I don't know your name. Heavy. Amy. So, people will say you are young, right? You are growing up. But according to this definition, you are growing older and older. Do you like it? Right? So, from the moment you took conception, right? You are getting older and older day by day. So you are older than you were 1 year ago, right? And you are older than the time when you enter this hall, right? So you are getting older and older and older. That is what we call jara. So in the world we say, oh, this girl is growing up and to be a woman and so on, but according to the teaching, you are getting older and older and older, and you don't like to be old. No? But can you escape it? Can you stop it? Can you run away from it? No. That is the one aspect of jara, I mean, or aging being dukkha, suffering. You don't like it, but you have to take it, right? And also, when one becomes old, there are many things that that one doesn't like. Now, when you get old, your body becomes weak. Not you are not strong as you are young, and that you will understand only when you get to be 70 years old or 80 years old. You cannot walk as fast as before, or you cannot pick up things and so on. And then your eyesight becomes weak, you have to put on glasses, and your hearing may be impaired and so on. So all these come from aging, because your body is getting older and older, it has become less and less efficient. And you no longer look young when you are 60, 70 or 80 years old. And then you forget many things when you get old. And when you get old, sometimes younger people don't want to be with you. Then they may say, oh, this old man, old woman, is interfering with us. We don't want to be near to him or to her. So you are like left out from the family or something like that. So all these you suffer because there is old age, there is aging. Because you become old, you have to suffer all these. And also sometimes people act like a child when they become very old. So all these you suffer because there is old age. So old age is also described as dukkha. Now, please turn to paragraph 44. About the end of the paragraph 44, what do you find there? It gives two reasons, right? The first one is difficult to understand. The second one is just because it is the basis for dukkha, it is also dukkha. But the first one is because it is sankhara dukkha bhava. So, I mean, because it is the formation dukkha. Now, you should understand at least three kinds of dukkha. Three kinds of dukkha. The first dukkha is called, in Pali, dukkha. Because it is a real dukkha. Now, wait. You go back to paragraph 34. There are different kinds of dukkha. Yes. So I want to pick up just those three. Mm-hmm. There are many, about seven or eight, but just three. Dukkha. Intrinsic dukkha or something like that. And then viparinama dukkha. That means dukkha when change comes. Viparinama means to change, so caused by change. And sankhara dukkha means dukkha because it is sankhara. Sankhara means conditioned. Anything that is conditioned is called sankhara. There are these three kinds of dukkha. Now when you hit yourself, you suffer pain. Right? That is a real dukkha. So that is called dukkha. Sometimes you are sorry. So at that time you suffer this real dukkha. This real dukkha is not difficult to understand. You don't need meditation to understand this dukkha. You hit yourself and there is pain and you say it is dukkha. Or you are sorry for something, and that is also mental dukkha. And the next one is dukkha when it is changed. That means sukha. Really, the pleasurable feeling is also called dukkha. Because when it is gone, you feel sad. You feel sorry. So you are enjoying something, right? When that enjoyment disappears, it's finished, then you feel something like a sorrow. So although it is sukha, it is pleasurable when it is existing, when it disappears, it is a cause for suffering. So even according to the teaching of the Buddha, what people call happiness is actually suffering. Suffering in change, because suffering when it is changed. And then the other one, the last one is called sankhara dukkha. I will talk about it later also. Sankhara dukkha, because it has a arising and disappearing. Anything that is arising and disappearing is called dukkha, sankhara dukkha. So there are these three kinds of dukkhas. Now here jara, I mean old age, is described as dukkha because for two reasons, right? So the first reason is because they are sankhara dukkha, because they are dukkha, because they are karma formations, and they are dukkha because they are the basis for dukkha. So according to this, jara or old age is suffering. Okay, later on you will understand more. And then the third one is death. Death is dukkha, not death is suffering. So death is suffering because it is the basis for dukkha. When death comes, everybody suffers. We are all afraid of death, and so when death comes, we are afraid and we don't want to die and so on. So death is the basis for dukkha. Therefore, it is described as dukkha. Now you will find that in 46, paragraph number 46, just above the verses, because it is the basis for dukkha, it is called dukkha, right? Death is a basis for suffering. Therefore, death is called suffering. So these are the reasons why they are called suffering. And then next one is sorrow. Sorrow is also suffering. So they are very easy to understand. And sorrow is suffering because it is the real sorrow, and also it is the basis for dukkha. It is a real dukkha, and also it is a basis for dukkha. Therefore, the sorrow is called suffering. That you find in paragraph 48. Okay, so sorrow, and then lamentation. Lamentation means crying, saying some things. Sometimes people cry, saying some things, so that is called lamentation, or in Pali, parideva. So lamentation is also called dukkha because it is sankhara dukkha, and because it is the basis for dukkha. And then pain, bodily pain and mental pain. So both are called dukkha or suffering because they are the real dukkha, and also they bring mental pain. Paragraph 50. And then grief. It is also mental pain. It is called dukkha because it is the basis for dukkha, and also it causes the bodily dukkha. It brings also bodily dukkha. The last one is called despair. That means intense sorrow. And it is also called dukkha because it is sankhara dukkha, paragraph 52, and also it burns the mind or consciousness, and also it is the, what did you say there? Of the body? Paragraph 52. Above the verse. It is dukkha because. Yeah, that one. So, these are the reasons why despair is called suffering. And then, association with unloved. Here, unloved means both animate and inanimate things. To be with a person who you don't love is suffering. To be with a thing who that you do not like is suffering. Now that is very plain, right? If you have to live with somebody whom you don't like, then it is great suffering for you. And if you have to live, let us say, in a place where you don't want to be, like a house, very old house, right? If you have to be using a car which is very old, then you don't like it. But say you have no money and you have to be with that old car, and that is also a kind of suffering. So to be associated with beings and also with the inanimate things that you don't like is suffering. And it is suffering because it is the basis for suffering. Paragraph 54. And the next one is to be dissociated from suffering. Not to be with those whom you like, those persons and those things that you like. You want to be with somebody and you cannot be with that person. So there is suffering. And you don't want to get away from, say, a very beautiful house, but you have to get away from it. So that is also called suffering. So to be dissociated from the beings and things that you love or that is lovely is suffering. It is suffering because it is also the basis for sorrow, which is dukkha. Now, next one is important. Not to get what you want is suffering. But here, Buddha explains that not you get what you want means sometimes people wish in this way. It would be good if I do not get old. It would be good if I do not die, and so on. Can that kind of wish be fulfilled? You say you don't want to get old, right? But you cannot get that wish. No. So that is what is called here. Not getting what one wants is suffering. Not just say you want a new car and you don't get it, that is suffering. That is another thing. But here what Buddha meant is, it would be very good if we are not subject to rebirth, if we are not subject to old age, if we are not subject to death, and so on. We may make wishes like that, but we will never get those wishes. So not to get what one desires is suffering means not to get the wish that we do not get old, we do not die, and so on. That is also suffering. Now the last sentence. In short, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. Okay, now you have gone through some of the truth of suffering. Now, and up till at this moment, the definition given by the Buddha, or the exposition given by the Buddha about suffering, is not difficult to understand, actually. Now, that birth is dukkha. You can understand easily that birth is dukkha, right? To get old is suffering. You can understand it. Do you need to meditate to understand this? You don't need to, huh? So you can easily understand. And death is suffering. And to be associated with those whom you love is suffering. To be dissociated from those who you love is suffering. Not to get what you want is suffering. Right? So these are not so difficult to understand. Now, the understanding of dukkha has two levels. One is a popular level. That means easy level. Now, the other level is philosophical level. That is more important. Just understanding dukkha on popular level is not enough. In order to get really wearied with life, to get really wearied with the mind and matter or five aggregates, you need to understand dukkha on the philosophical level. A deeper understanding of dukkha you need. So, the last statement Buddha made about the dukkha, the truth of dukkha is what in brief five aggregates of clinging are suffering. Or in short, the five aggregates that are subject to clinging are suffering. Now, that sentence is not easy to understand. Actually, if you want to understand this, you have to meditate. Only through vipassana meditation can you really understand this. Now, first, the five aggregates of clinging. Now, you must understand them. You know the five aggregates? You don't know? The first one is rupa, matter aggregate. Aggregate means a group. So matter aggregate, and number two, the second one is feeling aggregate. And number three is called perception. You will not find them here in this. One thing you must understand about Visuddhimagga is it was written by a monk for monks, and so many things were taken for granted. The other thought or assumed that you already understand the five aggregates, so he will not explain the five aggregates here. That is one reason why Visuddhimagga is difficult to understand. Now, a book written by a monk for monks, okay, meditating monks. So, number one, what is the number one? Rupa or Mera. The second one, feeling, in Pali, Vedana. And three is perception, Sanya. In Pali, it is called Sanya. And number four, it's called formations, mental formations. They call in Pali they are called sankhara, and five is consciousness, vijnana, consciousness. So these are called five aggregates. Now, we are made up of these five aggregates. Now, a man is made up of these five aggregates, a woman is made up of these five aggregates, an animal is made up of these five aggregates. So we find all these five aggregates in human beings, animals, and celestial beings or devas and so on. But outside living beings like trees, houses and so on, there is only one aggregate, the first one, matter aggregate. Now, these five aggregates can be the object of clinging. Now, you have to understand clinging also here. In Pali, it is called upadana, clinging. Clinging is taking hold of. Now, whenever we experience an object, if we are not mindful, we always hold on to that object. Sometimes we take that object, we grasp. You understand the word grasp? To take firmly, no? Do you grasp or you cling to the object by greed, by attachment, or sometimes by a wrong view. You may take this thing as a permanent thing. So if you take things as permanent, then you have one wrong view. If you take things as an atta, right, as the soul, then there is another wrong view. So whenever we experience an object, we tend to cling to that object, sometimes by greed, or sometimes by wrong view. So the aggregate which we can take, which we can cling to by greed or wrong view are called aggregates that are subject to clinging. That means there are aggregates that we cannot cling to by way of greed and wrong view. Now, in order to understand this, you have to understand Abhidhamma. Okay. For example, Nibbana. Although we may talk about Nibbana, we cannot really take Nibbana by way of greed, attachment, or wrong view. So Nibbana is not subject to clinging. And there are some types of consciousness like the path consciousness and fruition consciousness that are not the object of clinging. So here the aggregates that are object of clinging means aggregates that can be the object of clinging, that we can cling to. So here Buddha said, all five aggregates that are the object of clinging are dukkha, suffering. Now here, it is not easy to understand or to accept this statement. Because sometimes we enjoy ourselves. You enjoy good food, good companionship, or sometimes you may go to a show and enjoy. And you are happy at that time, right? Are you suffering or you are happy when you are watching a show you like? Or you are listening to a song you like? You are happy, right? Yeah. But according to the Buddha, you are suffering even at that time. Can you accept that? So according to the Buddha, you are still suffering at that time, although you are happy, although you are enjoying yourself. Because Buddha said, even the jhanas, now when you are in the state of jhana, you are very happy. There is almost no suffering of the kind people know. But even the jhanas, Buddha described as suffering. Now the immaterial jhanas are the highest of the jhanas. So when you get the immaterial jhana, you experience the highest form of the mundane happiness. But even Buddha describes them as suffering. Why? Hmm? Why are they said to be suffering, or why are they called suffering by the Buddha? There is a key, you must understand this. Buddha said, whatever is impermanent is suffering. Now we must understand this clearly. Whatever is impermanent is suffering. So if you want to know whether a thing is suffering or not, try to find out whether it is impermanent or not. Right? You want to know whether this is suffering or not, then try to find out whether it is a beginning and an end. I mean, whether it is impermanent. If it is impermanent, then it is called suffering by the Buddha. And whatever has arising and disappearing is impermanent. You say something is impermanent. Why do you say that thing is impermanent? Because it comes and goes, right? So whatever has a beginning and an end is impermanent, and whatever is impermanent is dukkha, suffering. Now that is taught by the Buddha. We must understand this. So you are enjoying yourself, but that enjoyment will come to an end, right? It will not last forever. So when it comes to an end and it is no more, there is no enjoyment. So Buddha's explanation is that whatever is impermanent is actually suffering or dukkha. Here, we must understand also the word dukkha. Whenever we hear the word dukkha, or the English word suffering, we think of pain only. Now, it is sometimes say we hit ourselves and we say, oh, it is dukkha. Right? So, when we say dukkha, we think it is only pain. Pain is dukkha. Or you are sorry and you have mental pain, right? But here, dukkha means more than that. More than pain, more than painfulness. It is more than that. And so in some books, it is translated as unsatisfactory. It may be a little better. The explanation given in the commentaries is that the mark of dukkha, the sign of dukkha, is constant oppression by arising and disappearing. Now that is important. Something is called dukkha because it is constantly oppressed by arising and disappearing. That is the meaning of dukkha, not just painful. If we understand dukkha as painful, our understanding of dukkha is very shallow. You hit yourself by accident, or you prick yourself, your finger with the needle, and there's pain. So you say, oh, it is dukkha, right? But that kind of dukkha, you can understand without practice of vipassana meditation. But what dukkha you must understand through the practice of vipassana meditation is different. That is being constantly oppressed by arising and disappearing. That you must understand. And that you can understand only when you practice Vipassana meditation and see things coming and going. Now you are practicing, let us say you are practicing Vipassana meditation. So when you practice Vipassana meditation, you have to make notes of the object. You have to observe the object. So there is one object and you try to be mindful of it, or you make a mental note. Huh? And let's say there is the thinking. Your mind goes out and you say thinking. Then after two or three notes, it is gone. But there's another object. Then you take that object. Suppose there is a sound. Then you take that sound and say hearing. And it disappears. It is finished, no more. Then there's another object like pain in the body. Then there's pain, you make notes. And then there's another object and you make notes of it and you see it arises and it disappears. So when you have to take these objects one after another and see them as arising and disappearing, many, many objects, you come to the understanding that, oh, everything is oppressed by arising and disappearing. That constant oppression by arising and disappearing is what Buddha meant by dukkha. So that is what I call philosophical understanding of dukkha. That is very important. Most people don't understand dukkha in that way, especially those who do not practice Vipassana meditation. So you can get this kind of understanding of dukkha only through Vipassana meditation. Now you listen to my talk and I'm talking to you, or you may read books on this and you think you understand. But that understanding is not your understanding. That is the, I call them borrowed understanding. It is not your own understanding. Somebody says this and you say, oh, it may be true. Or you read in a book and then, oh, it is true. But unless and until you see for yourself, through practice of Vipassana meditation, that knowledge is not your knowledge. So by practice of Vipassana meditation, we are making these kinds of knowledge our own knowledge. Only then is it called true Vipassana knowledge. So Vipassana knowledge cannot be gained through just listening to talks or reading books or just speculating. You have to practice. That means you have to observe objects as and when they arise, when they are existing, that means at the present moment. So that is why in Vipassana meditation, to be mindful of the present object is very important. Only when you observe the object at the moment can you see it arise and it disappear. If you are not looking at something, you will not see it, right? Okay, take the example of the lightning. Are there lightnings in this country? Lightning and thunder, right? So suppose you are looking at the sky. There are clouds and you are looking at the sky. And then there is a flash of lightning. Because you are looking at the sky and you look at the lightning, when it flashes, you really see the lightning. If you don't look at the sky at that moment, you will not see the lightning. Right? If you look at the sky before it flashes and not at the moment it flashes, you will not see. Right? So only when you are looking at the lightning, when it flashes, do you really see it. Right? In the same way, only when the object is present and you are observing it or making notes as seeing or whatever, do you really see it. Otherwise you don't see it. So that is why it is very important that you make note of or you observe the object at the moment. So here, every object you watch through Vipassana meditation, you know that every object comes and goes, and so there is a sense of being oppressed by something, and that something is arising and disappearing. So that is very important. So we must understand dukkha on this philosophical level also. Only then will our understanding of dukkha be complete. Otherwise, our understanding of dukkha may be shallow and not enough to push us to getting wearied with mind and matter. So getting wearied with mind and matter is a very important stage in Vipassana meditation. Now here, this kind of understanding is not explained in the commentary. In the commentary, what is explained is, because these five aggregates are also the basis for dukkha, they are also called dukkha. That is also easy to understand. Because you have these five aggregates, because you have this body, you will suffer old age, you will suffer disease, you will suffer death, and then you will suffer sorrow, lamentation, and so on, so long as you have this body, right? So this body is also said to be dukkha. So that also is not so difficult to understand. But the other thing, to see the constant oppression by arising and disappearing is important, and that you see only through Vipassana meditation. So this is the understanding of dukkha. Now you can understand that only through Vipassana meditation can you really understand the noble truth of suffering, right? If you do not practice Vipassana, you may be able to talk about dukkha, but that is not deep understanding of the dukkha. So that is why we need to practice Vipassana to understand the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering. Now sometimes people say, oh, I'm very wearied with my life because I'm suffering. I have chronic diseases, or I met with failure and so on. But these people don't really understand dukkha. Right? Do you think they really understand dukkha? Their understanding of dukkha is very shallow, right? Because they are in one or another way of suffering, and so they think it is suffering. What if they are prosperous, and if they are healthy and so on? Will they understand dukkha? No, if they don't, they don't practice, they will not understand, right? So it is only through Vipassana practice that you can really understand the noble truth of suffering. So let us go back again. The first one. What is suffering? Birth, right? Birth is suffering, and then aging is suffering, and death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair are suffering, and then association with the unloved is suffering, separation from the love is suffering, not to get what one wants is suffering. What is next? First, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. So now you understand why they are called suffering. And the two levels of the understanding of dukkha. And also the translation of dukkha as suffering is not adequate. Because dukkha means more than suffering, right? So, what is the mark of dukkha? Good. So if you want to see dukkha, you must see that. The constant oppression by arising and disappearing. So can you find out anything in the world which just arises and does not disappear? No. Even the buildings, they may stand for 100 years or 200 years, and then in the end, they will disappear. They will become old, and then they will have to be demolished. So, there is not a single thing in the world that has only the beginning and not the end. Since everything is has beginning and an end, we say everything is oppressed by the arising and disappearing. So there is no gap between the arising and disappearing. No break. That is why they say constant oppression by arising and disappearing. Now here, in passing, I want to tell you about the word sankhara. Are you familiar with the word sankhara? In some of my talks, I may have explained it. You want to hear it again? Now, whenever you find the word sankhara in Pali, you should be very careful. Because it can mean two things. One is opposite of the other. Sankhara can mean something that produces. And it can also mean something that is produced. So the first meaning is the active meaning, and the second is passive meaning. So both the producer and what is produced can be called sankhara in Pali. And that makes the understanding of the word sankhara more difficult. Because whenever you find the word sankhara, you have to find out, you have to know in what sense it is used. Whether it is used in the active sense or in the passive sense. And that is why also the word sankhara cannot be translated by just one word or just a group of words. Sometimes people say sankhara as volitional activities. Then you cannot use this translation volitional activities for every sankhara you find in the books. Sometimes sankhara means something that produces, and sometimes it means something that is produced. So you should understand what meaning is required in a given context. Now, if you're familiar with the dependent origination, there is a saying, avijja paccaya sankhara. Dependent upon avijja, ignorance, sankharas arise. That is one sentence in dependent origination. So you find the word sankhara there. The word sankhara there should be understood in the active sense. Sankhara means those that produce some other thing. So there the sankhara means karma. Avijja paccaya sankhara. Because there is ignorance, we do kusala karma or akusala karma. We do good deeds or bad deeds because we have ignorance. But sabbe sankhara anicca, now that is another saying, sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas are impermanent. Now in that sentence, sankhara is to be understood in the passive sense. Here, all sankhara means all those that are produced or that are conditioned. So all those that are conditioned are impermanent. So there, you cannot translate sankhara as volitional activities. If you translate the sankhara there as volitional activities, you are wrong. So you have to be very careful about the word sankhara. And then there is the word sankhara khanda, among the five aggregates, the fourth aggregate is called sankhara aggregate. So there also the word sankhara is to be understood in the active sense, something that produces or that conditions. And in Pali, the word sankhara is used in plural, or almost always in plural. Now, the five aggregates. The first aggregate is rupa aggregate. Metta, so it is not difficult to understand metta aggregate. Now, the second aggregate is feeling aggregate. That means you have feeling in your mind. Suppose you have pain in the body, and you experience that pain with your mind. And in your mind there is a mental state called feeling. So that feeling can be sometimes pleasurable feeling, sometimes displeasurable feeling, and sometimes neutral feeling. Sometimes you are happy, sometimes you are sad, sometimes you are neither happy nor sad. So these three kinds of feeling are called feeling aggregate. So every time you experience an object, there is this feeling. You may not be aware of that feeling, but there is always feeling. So when you see something, you may see it with pleasurable feeling, or you may see it with displeasurable feeling, or sometimes you may see it with neutral feeling. So there are at least these three kinds of feeling, and they are called feeling aggregate. And then the next one is perception. Now that is difficult to understand. Now what is perception? What is perception? So here, the word sanya, now in the Pali word sanya means making a mark. Now you may have seen carpenters building a house or making things like this table and so on. And then they make marks on the wood, on the timber, right? So this part is cut off, or this part is to be taken, or this part is to be used as a fort or as a boat and so on. So they make marks on the timber, and these help them to remember or to recognize when they see it later. In the same way, whenever we experience an object, our mind makes a mark of that object. Now that is why when we experience it again, we are able to recognize it. Suppose you see a man or a woman. You may not know, or you may not be aware that your mind has made a mark of that person. But your mind has made a mark. And so when you see him or her later, you recognize that person. Or it is he or it is she that I saw a few days ago or a month ago and so on. So this kind of making mark is what is called sanya, possession aggregate. And that sanya can be a correct sanya or incorrect, a wrong sanya. And on that sanya, we base our actions. That is why we need to, it is important to get a correct sanya with regard to the objects we observe. Sometimes, let's say in the evening when it is a little dark, you see a robe and then you think it is a snake. Right? That means you have made the wrong sanya there. So you think it is a snake and you may shout and you may run away from it. You are very afraid because you think it is a snake, right? But it is not really a snake, it is a robe. But you have made a wrong sanya, your mind has made a wrong sanya, and so you act accordingly. So it is important that we need to have right sanya. So that sanya is translated as in English as perception. So whenever you find the word perception aggregate, please understand that it means making a mark. Making a mark for recognition later. And then sankhara aggregate. Now sankhara aggregate means a group of mental states headed by volition. You know the word, you know volition, right? Volition is the translation of the Pali word chetana. It is a mental state that encourages you to do something, that pushes you to do something. So that mental state is called volition or chetana, and it is present with every type of consciousness. It is compared to a monitor in a class. I don't know whether that word is still used. When I was young, they were a class. And one pupil is called a monitor. So he is the head, the leader of the other pupils. So that kind of person works for himself as well as encourages others to do their work. So chetana is like that. Chetana always encourages other mental factors to do their own function, and at the same time it does its own function. So that mental state is called in Pali chetana or volition, and that is also called in sankhara. So the mental states that are headed by chetana are called sankhara aggregate. And there are altogether 50 mental states that we call sankhara aggregate. So you can read about the aggregate in that big book also. No, not here. You are good. You have to go to another chapter. So the last one is called consciousness aggregate. Consciousness, this word also is not accurate, but we have to stay with it because we do not know any other better word for the Pali word citta or vijnana. But here consciousness means just the awareness of the object. And it is said that consciousness is always with us, all through our lives. So from the moment of conception until the moment of death, there is consciousness. Now, when a person has fainted, you say this person is unconscious. Sometimes people became unconscious in an accident or when they have disease, right? Although they are said to be unconscious according to popular usage, according to Abhidhamma, they are with consciousness, even when they are said to be unconscious. So even when you are asleep, there is consciousness or mental activity going on. You are not without consciousness when you are asleep. So that awareness of the object is what is called vijnana or citta in Pali. And that vijnana or citta is always accompanied by other mental states. The feeling mental state, perception mental state, and sankhara mental state. So consciousness is always accompanied by the other mental states. So in one experience of seeing, we can see all five aggregates. So when you see something, the something you see is matter aggregate, right? Suppose you see a flower. The flower you see is matter aggregate. And you have the eyes. So the eyes are also, what are the eyes? Mind or matter? Matter. So the eyes are also matter. And then you see that you see the rose, and there is a seeing in your mind. That seeing is consciousness aggregate. And while you see the rose, you may have the feeling, pleasurable feeling, or maybe unpleasurable feeling if you don't like roses, or neutral feeling. So there is a feeling also when you see the rose. And along with it, your mind makes a mark of rose. Oh, this is a rose or something like that. And also, there are other mental states arising with that consciousness regarding the rose. Say the Chetana encouraging or telling other mental states do their own function and so on. Let us say you like the rose and you are attached to it, so there is attachment. Or you don't like it and you have dosa, you have anger or ill will for the rose, and so there is dosa. So all these are called sankhara aggregates. So in one experience of seeing, we can understand these five aggregates. So actually, in order to understand the five aggregates, you don't have to go to a book. You find all five aggregates in yourself. So at every moment of seeing, hearing, and so on, there are all these five aggregates that are going on and on. So these are the five aggregates. Now you understand the five aggregates? You remember them? Okay. Number one aggregate, matter aggregate. Number two, feeling aggregate. Number three, perception. Number four, sankhara aggregate. And number five, consciousness aggregate. It is important that we take any of these five aggregates as object when we practice vipassana. So vipassana takes only these five aggregates that are subject to clinging. as object. So we come to the end of dukkha, or the noble truth of suffering. Can you ask some questions about the noble truth of suffering? Number four is a group of 50 mental states. One of these 50 mental states is, in English, volition, and in Pali, cetana. C-E-T-A-N-A. And that cetana is also called sankhara, because it conditions other mental states, or it helps other mental states to do their own function. Here, the name of the cetana, sankhara, is applied to all 50 mental states. And so all 50 mental states are called sankhara aggregate. Actually, sankhara is just one, but it is the leader of all these 50 mental states, and so all 50 mental states are called sankhara aggregate. But in fact, sankhara is the name of cetana, of volition, which is just one among the 50 mental states. Now you understand? Any more questions? Huh? Okay. In order to understand the first noble truth in depth, what must you do? Mm-hmm. So reading books enough? No. Listening to talks enough? No. So you have to see it for yourself, right? So in order to see it for yourself, you have to practice, because this kind of understanding cannot be borrowed from any other person. I cannot transfer it to you, and you cannot transfer it to me. You have to do your own, you have to make your own effort, and I have to make my own effort. So that is one aspect of Buddha's teachings. Buddha's teachings actually cannot be transferred to another person. I cannot give my samadhi to you, right? You cannot give your samadhi to me. What I can do is give you instructions how to get samadhi, right? Because samadhi is in your mind, and I cannot enter in your mind and then make samadhi there. So in Buddha's teachings, we have to rely on ourselves for understanding, for the true understanding of, say, here, the noble truth of suffering. And the noble truth of suffering can be understood only when we practice vipassana meditation. We may think that we understand noble truth by reading books and listening to talks, but still our understanding is not enough, or not deep enough. So we have to understand it deeply, that even what are called pleasures in the world, we understand them as dukkha or suffering. And also when we understand this, we can easily accept the Buddha's teaching that all the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. And when we understand this, we will not accuse Buddha of being a pessimist. You know the word pessimist? So many people say that Buddha was pessimistic. Right? Buddha's teachings are pessimistic because they say we don't like Buddhists because you always talk about dukkha. Right? But what we are saying is not just what is bad in the world, I mean in life, it is a fact. So what Buddha said was the fact, not just one part of the fact. And Buddha did not stop at saying there is dukkha. Buddha also said that there is a cause of this dukkha, and there is the cessation of this dukkha, and there is a way that will lead you to the cessation of dukkha, right? So how can we accuse Buddha of being a pessimist? A pessimist is, it is dukkha and then you cannot do anything, right? You have to just surrender to dukkha and do nothing. But Buddha did not say that. Buddha did not stop there. At first he told us that, life is suffering. Life is suffering because it is suffering. It is a fact. It is a reality. And then he didn't stop there, but he said, and that suffering has a cause. And I have discovered that cause. And then that suffering can be made to end. That suffering will come to cessation. And here is how, what to do to end that suffering. Okay, now, in order to understand the Four Noble Truths, you have to understand a simile of a doctor. A doctor first diagnoses a patient, right? So he examines the patient, and then he says, you have this disease. And then he will tell him, I know what causes this disease. Then the patient wants to know, can my disease be cured? Buddha said, yes, it can be cured. It can come to cessation. Then he will ask, the patient will ask, what medicine should I take? Then the doctor will give him medicine. In the same way, Buddha gave us the Four Noble Truths. So if you understand that, similarly, you understand the Four Noble Truths. So now we come to the second Noble Truth, the Noble Truth of the Origin of Suffering, or the Noble Truth of the Cause of Suffering. So Buddha did not discover that everything in the world is suffering, but he also discovered the cause of this suffering. Now, it is important for all beings to get rid of suffering. We don't like suffering and we always want to get free from suffering. But when we want to get free from suffering, we must know what causes this suffering. Suffering is already here and we cannot just crush it. So if we want to get free from suffering, we must know what causes this suffering. Until we know the cause of suffering, we will not get free from suffering. We will not get anything to get free from suffering. Like a disease, right? A person has a disease, and if the doctor doesn't know what causes this disease, he cannot cure it. Only curing the symptoms is not the real answer. So you must deal with or treat the cause of that disease. So in the same way, now we have this disease of suffering. Then we want to get rid of this disease. Then what must we do? We must first find out what causes this disease. And when that cause is found and destroyed, then the disease will disappear. So this is in this logic that we must understand the second noble truth, the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is said that Buddhas always always get to the cause and not to the effect. Something like, say there is a mango tree. There are mango fruits now. Since there are already fruits and on the trees, we cannot destroy them. Let us say we don't want the mango fruits. But now they are on the tree, and we cannot do anything about this. But if we do not want the fruits in the future, we can do something. Say we can put chemicals in the roots and so on, so that the tree loses its ability to produce fruits, right? So in that way we can do. So that means we can act on the cause, not on the effect, because effect is already here and we cannot do anything about it. But we can do something about the cause of this effect. So when the cause is treated, when the cause is removed, then the effect is also removed. So it is very important that we know the cause of this suffering. So in finding the cause of suffering, or in pointing out the cause of suffering, Buddhism stands unique among all religions. Now you have heard about other religions, right? So they may point out to creation of the God or the Brahma as a cause for everything in the world, right? God created this world, or the great Brahma created this world, and they end there. But in Buddhism, no God, no creator God or Brahma is recognized. Instead, Buddha pointed out that this is the cause of suffering. Not the creation of the Brahma, not the creation of the God, but this craving. This is the cause of suffering. So if we want to get rid of suffering, if we want to destroy suffering, we must destroy the cause of that suffering. And Buddha said, I have discovered that cause of suffering. And that cause of suffering is stated as tanha in Pali. And tanha is translated as craving. You crave for something. You long for something. But the word tanha, the literal meaning of the word tanha is thirst. Thirst for sensual objects, thirst for sensual pleasures, and that thirst is called tanha in Pali. But nowadays, this word is translated as craving. So Buddha pointed out that the cause of this suffering is tanha, or craving, or attachment. And that tanha is described as producing rebirth. Now you may turn to paragraph 61. So you see there, how is it said there? Producing rebirth or something. Pono bawa, pono bawika. Other becoming? So this thirst or tanha or craving produces rebirth. So whatever rebirth we had is the result of this tanha. Now we had tanha in the past lives, and that tanha produces rebirth here, we as human beings. So we are born as human beings because we had tanha in the past. And we still have tanha in this life here. So this tanha will produce or create new rebirth in the future. So in this way, it goes on like a chain reaction. The tanha here producing tanha, the rebirth there, and the tanha there producing rebirth in yet another existence, and so on. So this tanha has the ability to produce rebirth. So whatever rebirth we had is actually the result of that tanha in the past. So this tanha has the power or ability to produce rebirth. This tanha is again accompanied by delight or something. In Pali it is called Nandiraga. Means that the delight and attachment is the same as craving. And then the last one is, how is it translated there? Next one. Oh, before that, tatra binandini. Taking delight in this or that existence. Okay, that means this tanha, wherever a person is reborn, the first active moment in that life is accompanied by tanha. Even if you are born in hell, you will be attached to that life because of that tanha. So this tanha is take delights in here and there, that means in this life and that life. Where in whatever life you are reborn, even as a small insect, the first moment, the first active moment in that life is accompanied by that attachment to that life. So that is why we say life is precious to every being or something like that. So even though a person may be a cripple, he is attached to his life, right? He doesn't want to die. So wherever a person is reborn, this tanha arises as the first active conscious moment in that life, and that is attachment to that life. And that tanha is said to be of three kinds. Now I want you to understand these three correctly, because sometimes the translations are just the translation of the word is misleading. So there are three kinds of tanha. And they are, in Pali, kama tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha. I think you can find that in Visuddhimagga there, 61. After what are they? kama tanha. So sense desire or something. He said that I will talk about them later. Right? And does he give the chapter number and paragraph number where you can find the so you go to that chapter 17 and paragraph number also? What is the paragraph number? 235? So go to 235. What do you find there? So there are three kinds of tanha. Kama tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha. First, it says there are six kinds of tanhas. That is, tanha for visible objects, tanha for sounds, tanha for smells, taste, touch, and tamas. So there are six kinds of tanhas. Each one of those tanhas can be of three kinds also. So they are kama tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha. So how is kama tanha translated there? Is it called kama tanha when it rises and delighted with something like that? That is the second one. The first one, craving for sensual. The first one. Craving for sensual desires. Right. Yeah, that is the one. So that is kama tanha. So craving for sense desire. Actually, craving for sense objects. Now, the objects are all called sense objects, because they can be seen, they can be heard, they can be smelled, and so on. So everything we see, we experience in the world, we can call objects of senses. The object of the eye, object of the ear, and so on. And craving for those objects is called kama tanha. Now you want a new house, right? That is kama tanha. You want a new car? That is kama tanha, and so on. Because it is craving for the objects of the senses. So you are attached to something, and you are pleased with that attachment. You are pleased with that thing. So that is called kama tanha. And the next one is that is what I don't like. the translation is one thing and the meaning is another. Now you read further. What does it say?
Okay.
No, no. Finally, the company. Right. Okay. So, bhava tanha. So there are two words, bhava and tanha. So here, bhava does not mean existence. Bhava here implies something, the view that things are permanent. So that is why the same tanha accompanied by this view that things are permanent is called bhava tanha. It is not craving for existence, because craving for existence can be karma tanha. Existence is also the object of sense. But that karma tanha, when it is accompanied by this wrong view that beings are permanent, that things are permanent, then it is called bhava tanha. So bhava tanha does not mean craving for existence, but craving accompanied by a wrong view that assumes everything to be permanent. Now, there are views like, say, there is an atta in beings, and this atta is eternal, it is permanent, and so taking that to be permanent is called a wrong view. Attachment to life in general, right? Not attachment to the first life, right? If we have to say attachment for future lives, or just attachment to life. Any more questions? You have to remember what you learned today, huh? And you can talk with your mother. Say we finished two noble truths, huh? The noble truth of suffering and the noble truth of the origin of suffering. So tomorrow we will go through the other two noble truths. Only when a person realizes the four noble truths, does he become enlightened. Sometimes enlightenment is described as seeing the four noble truths. So seeing the four noble truths means not just thinking about the Four Noble Truths, not just reading or not just listening to a talk, but experiencing the Four Noble Truths through your practice. Sometimes people have the wrong belief that once they know about the Four Noble Truths, they have seen the Four Noble Truths. And there are many people who say, we can become a Sotapanna in just one morning. Right? So I can teach you the Four Noble Truths in just 1 hour, and then you say, I have seen Four Noble Truths. But that is as I said before, it is not your own knowledge, it is a borrowed knowledge. So that is not what is meant. So they should be seen by yourself or realized by yourself through your own experience or through practice.